It's a strange and wet spring. I turned 17 and crossed the marshy border that separates all that is good and bad of boyhood from all that is good and bad of manhood. Three men tried to kill my father. Then water and the actions of men washed away almost everything I knew.
That's Elise Blackwell, our featured writer today on Unbridled Aloud, and I'm your host, Kay Callison. The voice is that of Lewis Proby, the narrator of Elise Blackwell's new novel, The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. Lewis Proby is a distinguished scientist, a developer of chaos theory. At the age of 95, he's writing to us on the eve of Hurricane Katrina, spurred by this forecast of more devastation by water to try to make sense of what he's come to recognize as the most important time of his life, when he himself was caught up in a swirl of chaotic events surrounding the Great Flood of 1927. What he calls the few stories he will try to tell add up to a beautifully written, richly evocative narrative of the changing face of the South in 1927, as embodied in Cypress Parish, a fictional place located south of New Orleans on the Mississippi River. It's also about the impact of men corrupted by power and money upon the lives and fortunes of ordinary people, including the misguided decision to dynamite the Cypress Parish levee to keep New Orleans from flooding. It's also a coming-of-age story, filled with loves and losses of many kinds, among them that of innocence, both personal and cultural. Lewis Proby is the eldest of four children. His father, William, is a man of ambition and drive. He's worked his way out of poverty by way of the lumber industry, rising from waterboy to company town superintendent of Cypress. Just as ambitious for Lewis, William has agreed to let him work as a driver for Charles Segrist, the lumber company executive who commutes back and forth between Cypress and New Orleans. This is the account of young Lewis's first night on the town in the city of New Orleans.
Within hours of arriving in New Orleans for the first time in my life, I found myself in one of the city's opulent clubs, eating oysters and several foods bearing names I had never heard and whose ingredients I could not discern. The music, too, was unlike anything I knew. The musicians were white, but the music sounded closer to what I had heard coming through the door of the Tunk and the Negro Quarter, the few times my father had invited me to accompany him on his Saturday night rounds. Yet this music wasn't quite like that either. It was busier, filled with more notes. One of the musicians played a clarinet, and the ensemble included no singer. Under the music tinkled the sounds of people eating and conversing. The dance floor near the stage was occupied by a few older couples and one young couple who leaned against each other. Mr. Segrist insisted that I call him Charles, and I managed to comply about half the time, more often than not still calling him Mr. Segrist, or Sir. Though I kept part of my promise to my mother by sipping iced tea instead of champagne, I could not keep my full promise without being rude. The woman who joined us, the woman wrapped with great familiarity by Charles's arm, had hair sheared off at her chin and wore a dress hem shorter than any woman I had ever seen. The trombone player was in the Friar Society Orchestra, she told me. Some people called them the Rhythm King, so maybe you heard of them that way. But he bugged out after they moved to Chicago, said he didn't like the cold, said he couldn't stand to be away from New Orleans. Her name was Mignon. She was older than I was, of course, more mature than the girls I knew, but somehow she was also more girlish than the women of Cypress, even than Miss Fontenot. Part of this was her height. I had practically a foot on her, and she seemed tiny next to Charles, whom she called Charlie. I thought she was like a Thumbelina, that she could almost dance on a man's hand. She was thinner, too, than the women I knew, in her dress without real sleeves. The shape of her arm bones was visible, the lines of muscle. And yet she occupied her small space fully, using sweeping gestures and laughing with her whole body, and the tautness of her skin made her seem more ample than she was. I couldn't look at her without flushing. Charles took some fun with this, telling me to cover my lap with my napkin as though I wouldn't understand the joke. But Mignon herself was kind, speaking to me only a little about the music and the food. She asked no straight-on questions that would have made me reveal my ignorance. She searched with her dark eyes when she did speak to me, giving me one place I could look with what felt like relative safety, one place I could look without feeling the blush creep up my neck and red fingers. Charles spoke of the difference between old and new money and how most Americans, though more out west than in New Orleans, don't care nearly so much about where your money comes from as they do about how much you have. But it's still in your best interest to act like you have old money. A lot of money is better than a little, but old money is never worse than new. The key is to be vague about where you got it. When people ask, I smile, wave my hand a little so they see my nice manicure and say, right now it's a little lumber, a little sugar. Or better still, wood, I say, or raw materials. Most folks just peck around the question if they've got any breeding at all, and if they don't, they do me little good anyway. He held the candle to his cigar and puffed it until it smoked and burst like a steam engine. When Mignon rose to leave, using the term powder room, Charles ran his finger along her hem, seemingly for my benefit. I watched her walk away from the table, her steps in dainty time with the jazz coming from the stage. Two men, both older and one considerably stouter than Charles, stopped by the table for a greeting. I was introduced as my young friend, Louis Proby, and was flattered not to be identified as the chauffeur. The men were introduced by name, Hancock and Swallow, before they moved on to greet friends at another table. Charles told me then that they sat on the boards of more than one of the city's most important and richest banks. What's more, he went on, it's supposed to be a secret, though it isn't much of one, that Hancock was Comus at Mardi Gras year before last. You know what the saying of Comus is? I shook my head. The saying of Comus is sic volo, sic iubio. I concentrated, but my French had only confused what little Latin I had encountered reading. Charles smiled. It's not important, Louis, because you can look up whatever you want to know. In this case, I'll simply tell you. Sic volo, sic iubio. As I wish, so I command. Those two, I'll tell ya. Charles shook his head and shifted his gaze toward the elaborate chandelier that sprinkled our table with blue and pink light. They tolerate me because they know I might be one of them someday, maybe even someday soon. And if not, they will doubtless find some less noble use for me. When Mignon returned, Charles stood. As she passed him to take her seat in the booth, he swatted her hard on the bottom with his open hand. She laughed, not even in surprise, and my neck and face flushed all at once.
Elise Blackwell, reading from The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. I'm Kay Callison. Elise Blackwell, can you tell us where did you grow up and when did you start writing?
Sure. I grew up in southern Louisiana, and I started writing when I was about 5 years old. About a year later, I guess I was six, my maternal grandfather saw that I had a knack for storytelling, and he offered me a dollar for every story that I wrote. That kept me going for a while, and I think I got too prolific for him because he told me he couldn't afford me anymore.
Oh, really?
But he said, I hope you keep writing, but don't do it for the money.
Oh, that's funny. Well, tell us about the memoir or the memories that your grandfather started writing down.
It's funny, both of my grandfathers had some literary aspirations, but the grandfather that used to pay me a dollar to write a story sat down in his 80s and wrote his memoirs, and he didn't have any intention of trying to publish them. They were simply for the family, and eventually he finished it. And some of the information in the novel, and certainly the original inspiration for the novel, came from my grandfather's memoirs. And I hasten to add that the book is not based on my family history, but it's hard not to take those morsels from real life and work them into my fiction. I also use some actual stories from my family. The story about the boy who sticks pins in the end of his fingers to show off to the kids, and it turns out that that's a sign of his leprosy, and he was later interned at the leper colony in Carville, Louisiana. That is actually from one of my grandfather's stories.
Really? What drew you to the flood of 27 as the time setting for this novel?
That's a great question. I had already decided to set it in 1920s Louisiana, and I started to learn more and more about the flood, and it just seemed to make all kinds of thematic sense and dramatic sense to set it against the flood. for one thing, the flood not only interrupted the coming of age of my character Lewis and of Cypress Parish as a place, mm-hmm. but it also in many ways accelerated that growth. I also think that sort of natural disasters are an excellent opportunity to watch how human beings behave, to watch how people act in the face of tragedy and disaster, how they cope with it and how they move on from it, I think tells us a lot about human nature. And also the whole idea of the natural and the man-made coming together was exemplified in the 1927 flood in a way I couldn't have invented.
Right. Well, the other big parallel is that you had this novel finished and Hurricane Katrina happened.
It was a very difficult time. When I first heard the word Hurricane and Katrina next to each other, the book had been finished for a good while mm-hmm. and was sitting on an editor's desk. I had no idea what to do, and the parallels are stunning. So I pulled it back, and I sat on it, and I thought about it for a while. And ultimately, I decided I still loved the book and wanted it to be published and that the story was just important after Katrina as before. So what I did is the events of the book are actually basically unchanged, but I changed the narration. I had written it in third person, mm-hmm. and I changed it to be a first-person narration narrated on the eve of Katrina by Lewis. And I think that the fact of the coming storm, which, of course, we now all know what happened, adds some dramatic relief to the events of 1927. I just love the way Brad Watson put it when he read it. He said that the present haunts the past in my book, and I thought that was an interesting way to look at it.
Yes. The book also very much is a reminder of the old French expression, plus ça change, I think it's plus ça même chose. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Absolutely. Many of the ways that the disasters played out and the human reactions are so parallel as to be frightening.
Right. I also was so struck by the way you got the part about the animals in. Was that in there originally?
It was in there. The character of Rabbit, who, as an African-American, born very poor, didn't have a lot of options for bettering his life, but he had done so by training to be a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. And for him to leave behind his animals was just unthinkable to him because they represented, of course, creatures that he was personally attached to, the way that we and so many people in New Orleans during Katrina are attached to their pets. But also his animals were to him part of his livelihood mm-hmm. and in many ways symboled the chance that life could be better for him, life could be better for his descendants.
Right. Well, Lewis's terrier, Terrebonne, is very much a character in this novel. And when they do have to leave, Lewis's father euthanizes Terrebonne, you know, because he couldn't bring him into New Orleans to the shelter for the human refugees.
Yes, and it was, a harsh decision, I think, for Lewis's father, for William Proby. He realized the dog would be better off dead than starving to death or being stranded on a rooftop for weeks on end, which happened to lots and lots of dogs. Yeah, and devastating for the family because that dog is beloved.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about the character of Lewis Proby. At the very beginning of the book, from the get-go, Lewis says that just as a piece of wood, no matter how well polished and sanded it is marked by the conditions in which it was grown, who I am, he says, remains intimately gnarled with where I came from. And yet he has carefully tried to take his Southern accent out of his speech, something about trying to talk more and more like people on the radio, I think he says. Mm-hmm. Why do you think Lewis Proby tells us so little about his current life? And is there a stigma about being Southern in his mind, do you think, in terms of his professional career that he has pursued?
Sure. That's an excellent question. I'm going to answer the second part first. My dad, who happens to be from Mississippi, not from Louisiana, catches a lot of grief, and his new line is, well, somebody has to be from Mississippi. And I do think, I know that when I went off to graduate school in California, I worked hard to get rid of my Southern accent. I've allowed it to come back a little. I'm no longer ashamed of it. But I was told by teachers that people would underestimate my intelligence if I spoke with a Southern accent. Hmm. But for Lewis, And obviously he's gone very far in life. He's become an eminent scientist. He's developed a strain of chaos theory that has changed the way people in his field do science. He has been married. He has had a family. But I think for many people, when they get older, memories come back. The distant memories that come back are sometimes more real than what happened yesterday. I think, too, because Lewis is narrating the story on the eve of Katrina, that he's thinking about the past. He's thinking about the 1927 much more than he would be thinking about 1997.
Well, another thing that he says is, yet the older I get, and despite all my training as a man of reason and method, the harder I find it to understand anything at all. If you were to place side by side the historical account of something that happened, a painting of it, and a scientific explanation of how and why it occurred, you might still not understand it unless maybe you lived through it yourself. Even then, you'd succumb to forgetting. An old man may remember the facts of his youth, but he cannot always remember what they felt like. To what extent does this passage from in Lewis's voice express the thematic content of this novel, do you think?
I think it's one of the absolute central themes for me, is that the book is about our different ways of knowing. We have so many ways that we try to understand the world: news accounts, historical record, personal recollection, personal experience, family history, science, art, literature. And we need all of them to make any sense of things that happen. And I think for Lewis, I think one of Lewis's central flaws throughout his life has been that for a young man that wants so badly to understand the world, to write a natural history, to know how things work, to be able to describe things, he has a shallow understanding of human motivation.
That is so interesting, because he makes reference, Lewis does, to how amusing in a way he finds his attempts as a 17-year-old boy to be writing the natural history of Cypress Parish, as it were. And he makes reference to the essence of things. And at the end of the book, he says, although I have put together everything I know, I still cannot say what happened. Is the what happened the essence of things or events?
Very much. And I think what he wants is the meaning. Like, what, okay, this happened, this flood happened, I did this, I did that, but what does it mean? What does it mean about the human condition, and what does it mean about me as a person? He can remember being in love for the first time, for instance, but if he can't remember what he felt like, is he robbed of that experience? And I think that's the kind of thing that he worries about.
You've talked about this as a coming-of-age story, and it's also a love story between him and Nanette. And he says, because of the crevice that was created in the levee when it was dynamited, a crevice happened in his life, too. And he was never able to get closure. Does that equal essence or understanding for him at the end, do you think?
I think they're definitely intertwined. If he could have had more closure, he could have sort of written the end of the story for himself, but he was denied that. And I think that's one thing that disaster does to people. Mm-hmm. It robs them of closure. It interrupts their lives. All of their plans, all of their hopes are shifted, interrupted. And for Lewis, that means, among other things, not getting to finish watching his first love play out, mm-hmm. nor did he get to say goodbye. And I think that very much haunts him, as it would haunt anyone.
Of course, another thing that is extremely integral to this coming-of-age story has to do with the father-son relationship.
Yes, and the father-son story is very important to the novel. And at the beginning, before the flood, when Lewis is 17, his father's still larger than life to him. Mm-hmm. His father's a man who, despite not having any advantages, despite having crawled out of the backwoods to fell trees, is a man who knows how to get things done. A man who has ambitions to power, a man who's very capable, and he's larger than life, and Lewis looks up to him, but he shrinks sort of literally and figuratively as the novel goes on. And some of that is normal teenage rebellion, sons topple fathers, and some of it is prompted by the flood. Lewis is very harsh on judging his father's moral decisions,
mm-hmm.
and he, who his father thinks has the luxury of exerting finer moral judgment, makes some mistakes of his own, which greatly disappoints his father, and they do have quite a blow up there at the end.
True, and there's also the seduction of Charles Segrist and the life of New Orleans.
Yeah, and William Proby very much pushes Lewis to do that.
Yes,
he wants
does.
Him to rise in the world, but he doesn't necessarily like the outcome.
Mm-mm.
And I think Charles does, and he also, of course, introduces him to sort of, you know, short skirts and jazz mm-hmm. music and whiskey and people corrupted by money.
Mm-hmm. The other extremely important mentor to Lewis, because he teaches him how to see, is the painter, Gaspar Anderson.
Yes. Gaspar, I think, teaches Lewis probably more than anyone else. It takes Lewis a long time to see that. I think the immediate lessons he learns are from Charles, and they don't necessarily serve him well. But it's the lessons from Gaspar Anderson that are going to stick with Lewis over his life, that are going to influence his career and who he becomes as a man. And, of course, it's Gaspar who he in some way betrays.
Yes, by not trying to rescue more of his pictures from the flood when he can't find him there before the dynamiting of the levee. But how that one painting he takes out, how on earth do you think it ended up in a secondhand store in Metairie, Louisiana, when Gaspar was so important to Lewis?
My thinking is that Lewis very much abandoned his past for a while.
Wow.
There's a section of the novel where he talks about his natural history. Again, it's important to him and it's out on his desk. But for decades, it was in a careless box on a shelf in his closet. And I think he's just sort of rediscovering what was important to him, that what happened to him mattered, and that he sort of got it wrong at the time.
Hmm. Well, that just fascinated me. And really, the only record of that whole school or period of Gaspar Anderson's paintings was that one little piece that he rescued.
Right, there's a hole in his work. There's a crevasse in his body mm-hmm. of work caused by the flood. And there's the before and the after, except for that one. And that scene also gave me an opportunity to sort of let people know what happened to Gaspar, since the novel doesn't follow him.
Right.
And I wanted the reader, too, to understand that Gaspar had seen the devastation of his work to water, and then the idea that one's life work could just be lost like that, to me, is terrifying.
When we talk about the changes that you had to make, what did that do to the voice of the novel beyond putting it in Lewis Proby's voice? Whose voice is that in the natural history passages?
I think some readers are going to read that as authorial intrusions, but I see that as the voice of the sort of older, more objective Lewis Proby, mm-hmm. that is in Lewis Proby's voice, and that it's part of his effort to try to understand what happened to the various ways of knowing, and that's one of his ways.
Yes. To go back to that thing that he says at the beginning, if you were to place side by side the historical account of something that happened, a painting of it, and a scientific explanation of how and why it occurred, you still might not understand it. But in that passage, along with carrying the thematic content of the novel, also describes the structure of the novel.
Yes, that's very astute, and that's exactly what I hoped readers would see in it. And I do think that passage is metafictional to the extent that I want it to sort of justify or explain or at least hint at why I've written the novel the way I have, and what those sections about O Pliny the Elder and Roman history and river velocity are doing in the book.
And then the world of art, seeing the world that way.
Yes, and of course, you know, the novel itself is an attempt to paint the world from a certain perspective.
Right, and to paint it, that's true. Elise Blackwell, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to talk with us about the unnatural history of Cypress Parish.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you. Emily sat several yards upriver, sorting shells. Her face was turned into the breeze, and the mild wind lifted her hair as a single wide ribbon. I made a place for myself on the cut flat of the levee top between Emily and the spot Gaspar had chosen to set up his easel. While Gaspar painted, I tried to describe in my notebook what I saw. The water was high, of that there could be no doubt, but I had seen it as high before. Yet I had never seen the river move so swiftly or with so much internal turmoil. Never before had I felt the levee shimmy under me as it did then. I had twice seen unmoored cows sucked down into the mysterious darkness of the river, but never had I seen a whirlpool so large as the one that now churned before me. It was a cauldron capable of making not only a heifer, but a large house, or perhaps even something more, disappear from human sight. I jotted down an estimate of the river's overall velocity, but I knew the figure was useless. The river contained so many speeds and so many directions at once that an average number held no meaning. I scanned the brown widths and noticed the relative distance of back currents and eddies. I tried to determine which upstream rivulet was mostly tied. I shouldn't think you'd need anything on your palette but brown and a little green, I called to Gaspar. Look closer, the painter answered. My pen now loose in my hand, I tried to see the river as Gaspar saw it. White, I said, in the froth of the waves. Gaspar paused from his work and gazed at the whirlpool. There's blue there and black and even pink. I nodded. I can see them now. I felt on my face the moisture of the rain about to fall. You have the eyes of a scientist, not a painter. Gaspar wiped his brush with the blue cloth that usually hung from his belt and was now smeared with dozens of shades of color, most of them green. The move was efficient. One so long practiced it seemed unconscious. You make observations, he said. You describe the river by adding the sum of its parts, perhaps even contemplate the laws of nature that make it what it is. The river has no effect on you. What I set down is an interpretation. My picture is mine, not what someone else might see, and it is most certainly not the river. It's my painting of the river, which is a lot, but also nothing. I combed for something that might sound intelligent, but also diplomatic. I believe the river defies all of our efforts to capture it. Gaspar laughed and dipped his brush, quickly and just barely, into a glob of white paint, then deeper into black, adding the smallest amount of red to the resulting dark gray. That may be what the artist has in common with the scientist. We know our best efforts are doomed to be approximations. We have awe for our subjects of study. Know that they are more than we are. It's the engineers who have all the answers. My father said if it wasn't for the engineers, we'd be flooded out every year. Well, we're certainly sitting on engineering right now, so your father may well be right. But I know this. I know it's always a mistake to believe you can control something wild. He paused and added, of course, it's likely a mistake not to try anyway.
Elise Blackwell, our featured writer today on Unbridled Aloud. She was reading from The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish. Elise Blackwell is also the author of one previous novel, Hunger. She lives and teaches at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. This series of podcasts is sponsored by Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. Other writers we're talking with include Andrea Portis, Mark Cunningham, Mark Estrin, and Timothy Schaffert. For more information about The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish and other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including a long list of literary links and book study guides for most of their titles. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.